Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast, which once again comes from the live MK3D show that I do every month at the BFI South Bank in London. The shows are always packed, so we split them across two podcasts. Last week, we heard from Jonas Per Rasmussen, whose awards-fated film Flea is currently in UK cinemas, and Cherisha Taker, BAFTA-nominated for her short film The Black Cop. This week, there's more BAFTA glitz as we talk to Clio Barnard, director of Ali and Ava, which is up for Outstanding British Film and Best Actor. But we start with Peter Middleton and James Spinney, the makers of Notes on Blindness, whose new film, The Real Charlie Chaplin, is in cinemas and online now. So sit back, relax, and take a front row seat at MK3D, live from the BFI South Bank.
Now, if you're a regular, you will have heard me talking about a film called Notes on Blindness, which came out a few years ago, which I absolutely loved, and I sort of raved about it and how powerful it was. And the directors of that film have now made a documentary about another subject which is very, very close to my heart. It's a documentary about Charlie Chaplin. This is the trailer for The Real Charlie Chaplin, which I think sets up the film very, very nicely.
Mr. Chaplin,
are you
a communist?
You have no patriotic feelings about this country or any other country.
I have patriotism, and my patriotism rests with the whole world.
In the name of democracy, let us all unite!
He accomplished his life's dream, but I don't think he ever really got over his doubts.
He said to me, I used to be very famous. He needed an audience.
Everyone who gets too close to him, he'll end up suffocating. He couldn't help it.
Can I ask how old you were when you married him?
He was inaccessible in so many ways. I had grown up with the icon. But the man, I had no idea who the man was.
Please welcome Peter Middleton and James Spinney. Welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you, because I have been wanting to have you on ever since Notes on Blindness, which I just, you know, I loved. And I'm so glad that you've made this documentary. It's about a subject which is very close to my heart, and I know will be to many film fans. Why Chaplin? Have you both always been interested in Chaplin?
That's a really good question. I feel like we've always had an idea of Chaplin, like a lot of people, I'm sure, even long before we'd seen any of his films. Personally, I hadn't seen them until I was studying, and I first watched City Lights, I think, about the age of 17. And it completely overturned for me my idea of what silent cinema was, which actually I think maybe Chaplin had become sort of emblematic, I think, for people who haven't taken a deep dive of a sort of exaggerated, quite cartoonish version of silent cinema. I think because those films are often played at the wrong speed, and they've often been transfers of transfers, and so Chaplin is kind of fading away in the image. Whereas watching those, they just felt so fresh and subversive. And something which we talk about a lot in the film is, you know, this rapport that Chaplin instantly builds up with you as a member of the audience, that he kind of breaks the fourth wall, he looks out at you and creates this connection. And so, yeah, we were captivated by those films, but it came to us after Notes on Blindness through a producer called Ben Lindbergh, who had been speaking with the Chaplin estate for a long time about making a film, and the idea of being let loose in the Chaplin archives and be able to explore that extraordinary body of work, and also that that life story, which has been called one of the great rags-to-riches stories, was just an incredible...
And did you have sort of full cooperation from everybody that you needed it from?
Yeah, Ben, James has mentioned, our producer, he actually had a family connection with Chaplin. So his mother had been to ballet school with Geraldine Chaplin,
right?
Which is a pretty good inn, yes, in terms of you know, connections with the family. But he'd over a number of years have managed to build this rapport with the estate. And I think had always been pushing that, you know, there should be a long form documentary about Chaplin. And he so by the time we came on board, you know, we were given assurances that we'd have full kind of creative control, and the estate were enormously helpful to us, of course, and they have a remarkable archive there, and they gave us full access to Chaplin's complete kind of creative and personal archive, so all of his films and some fantastic materials, including this 3-day audio interview that was recorded with Chaplin in 1966,
yeah,
that had never been heard before, and actually kind of because of modern digital restoration techniques, had never really been usable. There were little fragments of it had appeared before, but we were able to really take a deep dive in that, in full knowledge that we could kind of bring that to life. And so that's really how it started, and it kind of fanned out from there.
You have a long-standing fascination with taped interviews. Anyone who knows Notes on Blindness, well, it's very hard to describe, but it's what you do is you use the original audio and then you dramatise it. We see some of that in the Chaplin film. Tell me about that technique. What is it about that technique that fascinates and obsesses you?
Yeah, it's something, as you said, that we used in Notes on Blindness, and it was very much inspired by Clio's work as well, the Arbor. I think for us, thinking about it in terms of this film, you know, Chaplin's life story, which spans 88 years and begins in 1889, which takes in these great works, and I think we felt very early on quite overwhelmed by just the scale of it. You know, it's a life that he sort of lived through cinema. He told his own story again and again as the tramp. And I think as we started to assemble it, we felt that we wanted to look for ways to kind of find present tenses within that, where we could kind of settle into the room. And it's also a response to kind of feeling, I think, overwhelmed by the fact that, you know, Chaplin's been dead for so many years now, and apart from his children, most people who knew him well are no longer with us. And so we felt sort of as though we were kind of following in the footsteps of other people who had traced his life back in the day, people like Kevin Brownlow, who we see in the film interviewing Chaplin's childhood friend, or Richard Merriman, who's the Life magazine reporter who got this 3-day interview with him in the 60s. And I think as we were listening to those recordings, we sort of felt transported into those spaces. We felt that we were in the kitchen of Effie Wisdom in Norfolk, age 98 and 91, I think she was, talking to Kevin about Chaplin's childhood. And similarly, listening to Chaplin tell his own story in his own words in this interview. And as we listened to it, we were looking at the hundreds of photographs that were taken of him at that time. And so I think, you know, in some ways, biography is quite an imaginative process, really, you know, particularly when with our previous film, Notes on Blindness, it was very much a collaboration with John Hull and his family, because they, you know, were co-authoring the film with us. But this felt a bit more like, I don't know, we begin the film with images of like a seance, and there's a sense in a way that it was a bit like that. You know, you've got all these fragments and you're trying to find a way to kind of find a journey through it. And so I think the dramatizations were a way to kind of do that whilst using this, you know, authentic documentary audio.
I think there's going to be lots of stuff in there that a lot of audiences won't know about. Some years ago, I had done a radio doc for Radio 4, which was in the Chaplin archive in Paris, and we were looking at, you know, Dadaism and the way in which his image had become, you know, taken on by the surrealists and had become something which I was discovering stuff I didn't know anything about. And at the beginning of your film, there is an awful lot of stuff that people are going to go, I had no idea about this, particularly this mass hallucination that everyone saw Charlie Chaplin at exactly the same time, because by that point he was the most reproduced form in the world. Was that new to you? Was that discovery?
I mean, yeah, it was. I mean, I think we have a sense, there's almost a sort of a cultural residue, isn't there, of like how, of the name Charlie Chaplin. Everyone, it brings to mind that image of the hat and the cane and that sort of silhouette outline. And for it to still be so sort of prevalent over 100 years since he
first started. One of the most recognisable silhouettes on the planet.
You'd have to say, yeah, wouldn't you? And so there's something in that. And the more we kind of looked into it, we were completely taken aback by these stories you referred to, of just how much more intense it was at the time when Chaplin first kind of took a step onto the screen in 1914. Within a couple of years, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the globe were regularly watching Chaplin films. And there's some fascinating stories that sort of came out about that. Just the way that image was replicated, because of course, you know, even in America at that time, you know, you had it was a real melting pot of cultures, and because the films were silent, it meant that you could have people who didn't share a language being able to sit next to each other in a cinema and experience the same thing, and that traveled across the globe. And you know, we found some wonderful stories about relating to that. You know, there was a favourite of ours is that, and which we weren't entirely able to corroborate, so it didn't quite make it into the film, is that there was. That in post-revolution Russia, that people were pulling down statues in churches and of czars and replacing them with effigies of the tramp. You know, you hear stories of these travelling picture shows going around, you know, the continents of Africa and so on, all of which is sort of just out of reach, not quite sure whether or not it's fact. But the point is that, you know, that these myths are so pervasive that says something about it in and of itself.
I hadn't ever heard, or I'd read of it, but I'd never ever heard the Monsieur Vadou press conference, which begins with him saying, "Let the butchery commence." And you cover in great detail the anti-communist stuff against him, driving him out of America. You also, of course, cover the issue of his relationship with women, which is at very best problematic. How difficult was it to deal with that stuff?
I think... If Chaplin's fame was this fame that didn't exist before him, you know, the type of celebrity that Chaplin experienced when he first stepped onto screen in 1914, there was no precedent for that.
Yeah, so he was first worldwide superstar.
Exactly. He was famous in a way that no one had been before because the technology just hadn't existed. And by contrast, I think the scandals with Lita Gray, his second wife, around their divorce and some of the things that she mentions about the abuse that she suffered during their marriage, were, I think, the first time the audiences were having to confront, I think, a sort of crisis of how to reconcile what she was saying with the image of this person that they had on screen. And she talks very movingly about how she didn't feel that she was believed because people couldn't reconcile what she was saying with the image of with their relationship with him, which was so powerful. But we wanted to put Lita's story front and center, and we wanted to not shy away from it. It's something that's, you know, making a film about Chaplin is a very complex thing, and there are so many facets to his character that we had to explore.
When you had the film finished, I imagine that there must have been stuff that you wanted to get in, but, you know, you have to make it into a... How much stuff did you not get in? How much is not in the film?
I mean, there are whole shadow cuts of this film. I mean, and actually, we were talking about this earlier on. That the great thing is that we feel like there is still, you know, any number of other films about Chaplin that could be made. You know, there's a wonderful quote that we kind of hit upon quite early on in our research that a journalist had written in the early 1920s. That, you know, there are more myths, rumors, and legends about Chaplin than many a religion. Yeah. And it is a sort of a wormhole that you can plunge down. I mean, in terms of like archive and bits and materials that we felt like we were close to, but weren't quite able to get our hands on, there are some stuff out there.
I mean, I love the fact that even after watching the doc, you still think there's still more. There's still more to find. I mean, and also as somebody, I used to be very sniffy about Chaplin. I used to have the thing about, well, you know, Buster Keaton, great Chaplin, sentimental, and then I had that kicked out of me by Mike Hammond, who's a great Chaplin scholar, who said, "You've never seen Monsieur Vadou, have you?" And I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Well, you don't know what you're talking about." So I really like the documentary very, very much. I asked you to pick two films as well that were kind of, you know, inspirational. Let's go for All Mankind first. For people who don't know it, because it's 1989, what is For All Mankind?
So For All Mankind, as you say, is a film made in the late 80s by a filmmaker called Al Reinhardt. Now, so it's a film about the sort of Apollo project, the sort of very meditative and lyrical film that folds in these sort of interviews with NASA astronauts. And it is very much a film about space, but what particularly kind of took me was it's as much of a feeling, yes, about that kind of voyage and exploration, but very much a film about the Earth as well. And it brings into focus just the sort of the vulnerability and fragility of our planet here. And I saw it at quite a sort of formative stage, I suppose, in my career when I it wasn't even a career then, it was sort of just starting out in filmmaking, and has an interesting kind of coda to where I'm at now as well. So yeah, it was a very influential film for me. And
should we have a look at the clip?
Yeah.
Hello, I just said you'd have to see this planet to believe it. This is just so that you guys don't get too excited and forget what your job is down there.
We're ready for what we're about to see.
In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
We had a little tape recorder on board, which you could listen to the music. We were allowed to carry a personal cassette on there so you could play the music. Mine was country music.
Hi, this is Buck Owens from the Buckaroos. We came down to the studio and we thought we'd put together a little thing that you could take along with you on your trip. Now, you know, when you get back, they're probably going to put you in the movies. So the first thing we're going to do for you is to play a little song called Act Naturally. It goes like this. They're going to put me in the movies. They're going to make a big star out of me.
Second appearance of a Walkman. I could watch that all day because I'm in love with all of that stuff. When I went to America and I went to the, you know, the Air and Space Museum, and you see the capsules that came back, and it's like really, you know, old valve switches, and you see the, you know, the chair where the astronaut's butt is, that is literally that far away from the outside of the hull, which was on fire as it was. How they ever got back alive is astonishing to me, and I love that. I just love the way that captures it. So, okay, great. Filmmaking, I can see that. Documentary, great. Your choice.
So my choice is a film that was my grandparents' favourite film. And we used to watch it when I was quite young. I think, like Jonas, I'm questioning, yeah, was it a family film? I don't know. So it's just a film that's always been in my life, and that that I feel like if it was taken away, I'd be somehow deprogrammed in some way. It's the film Cabaret, which I just remember being, I mean, we've talked a bit about that thing that Chaplin can do when he looks at you and that connection. And I remember feeling kind of just pulled into this world and into, through the charm of like Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey and of the Kit Kat Club as well. I sort of, we knew it as kids just back to front, although I guess a lot of it was going way over our heads. And I've sort of then loved it throughout my life. I also think that the Kit Kat Club makes it the perfect musical because by having that, no one has to do the thing, that awkward thing in musicals where they're sort of talking, and then they start to sing. Like, you can just sing in the Kit Kat Club in this sort of parallel world, which is sort of this psychological space, and sing about what's happening, but in a very indirect ways, and yeah.
It's weird because Cabaret is often cited as the musical that people who don't like musicals like for exactly that reason, that people don't, with the exception of Tomorrow Belongs to Me, which kind of makes, sort of makes diegetic sense. But we're going to show an entire song from the Kit Kat Club. We were looking at sort of cutting this down, but there isn't anywhere to cut it. And also, I think it's relevant in relation to Chaplin, because what's happening in this, although it's a musical, many of the expressions and the way in which the story is being told owe such a debt to silent cinema. So, here we go.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around. That clanking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
So do you watch it often?
Yeah, once every year or so, I'd say. I mean, my partner Jude loves it too, and so yeah, and we kind of just constantly sing it to each other, really. Yeah.
My daughter had a birthday a few years back, and we said, "What do you want to do?" She said, "I want to go and see Cabaret in the cinema." So we went to the Prince Charles to see it on the big screen, and it's lovely to be able to play that on the big screen, because it's one thing seeing it at home, but it needs to be projected. And it's also that that brilliant combination of it's a musical, but it's a horror film. And it is really, really horrifying.
Absolutely. But I feel like it shows that you can deal with huge subjects with a real lightness of touch. And they just show, I mean, that Tomorrow Belongs to Me is a real turning point in the film, because I feel like you're glimpsing things right from the beginning. Yeah. You're seeing little shades of things, but they understand that you don't need much. And the way that the final shot mirrors the opening shot into a mirror, but you're seeing all these brown shirts in there at the beginning.
Congratulations on The Real Charlie Chaplin. It opens in the UK next Friday.
Yeah, that's true.
And as I said, I think the best thing is you don't have to know about Chaplin to enjoy it. But I think even if you do know stuff about Chaplin, there will be stuff in there that you haven't seen before. Even if you heard it first, that it was so lovely to hear those, and particularly the Monsieur Verdoux conference, which was really fascinating to me. So congratulations, and I wish you every success with the film. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Again, to BAFTA nominations. Another film that featured in the BAFTA nominations is Ali and Ava. Here is the trailer for Ali and Ava.
You'd just be a bit overprotective, yeah, about you and me.
You and me. You and me?
What, is that a...
It's not a thing.
I'm joking.
Joking.
We're separated. We live in the same house. Separate bedrooms. You need something to keep you
alive. Just focus on that. Nothing else.
I like being here with you.
I like every part of you.
I'm a six pack.
Why didn't you tell me?
She's telling you now.
The director of the film was already mentioned by our previous guest as an inspiration. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Clio Barnard. How lovely to have you here.
How lovely to be here, and thank you.
How are you?
Inviting me. To be honest with you, I'm really, really exhausted. But yes.
Exhausted because you're working on something?
I'm working on something. Yeah, there's a very brilliant director, Dylan Southern, is in the house. And so he knows. Yes, I've been working on a TV show that is has me slammed. So our dialogue editor said it's a bit like someone's put a blindfold around... put a blindfold, like a kid's game, where they put a blindfold on you, spun us around, then go run for the finish line. So that's the... I'm a bit discombobulated.
But in a good way?
Or? I mean, I guess what I've realised is that making something like Ali and Ava, you have time but no money. And this is, you know, money but no time. And there are, you know, there are...
Which is
there
worse.
Are definite,
which is better, which is worse.
Ali and Ava, I don't know. Time, there's a lot to be said for time, yeah.
So, for people who haven't seen it yet, because it hasn't yet opened in the UK, what's the story of Ali and Ava, and where did it come from?
The story of Ali Neva is, it's a love story. It's about, it's set over a lunar month, and it's about two people who are a catalyst for change in each other's lives. And, you know, both of them are stuck for different reasons, and they both allow each other to move on.
And as with all of your projects, one of them is often led into the other one. Where did the inspiration for these characters come from? Because there are people who directly have inspired the characters that we see on screen.
Well, Moe Hassan is a DJ, landlord, and actor, and he had a small part in The Arbour, yeah. And he inspired the character of Ali, and someone called Rio, who I met through, well, I was making Selfish Giant, and really they're people that I got to know and love and wanted to see their stories writ large on the big screen, their so-called ordinary lives, yeah. Which actually I think are extraordinary lives.
And there's a lot of music in the film, mm-hmm. which is, you know, something of a departure for you. So tell me about that embrace. It's kind of verging on being a musical.
Well, Tracy O'Riordan here, who's my producer of many, many years. We've worked together since the very, very start. She knows that there's part of me that's always secretly wanted to make a musical, and I think she has too. So, yes, it's my sort of, I guess it's a sort of diegetic musical with a bit of dance in it as well.
I'm going to show a clip, which is the clip with the Stones in the car, which is really beautiful, and I think... It was interesting, we were just talking about cabaret, is, you know, the music is contained and it's on stage and then there's the thing, so you don't have the people bursting into song. But what you've managed to do is to negotiate that thing about it's a musical without ever getting people to have to go, I'm sorry, why are people bursting into song? Because the dance is kind of spontaneous. Anyway, you don't need me to explain it, it'll explain itself. Here we go.
Look at this. Look at this. That's Matty Lee.
Matty Lee!
Oh, you!
I think we've test run that two or three times, and every time I see it, it just puts such a smile on your face. What was it like to film it?
It was fun, Mark. It was fun. Yeah. I'll keep mentioning Tracy. She sat right there, and I sort of wish she'd come and sit here.
Tracy?
Yes, come on.
My show.
Yeah, you can do what you want.
Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a bit unexpected.
Yeah.
So, tell me about shooting that scene.
Well, actually, when you were writing it, we were slightly with, is the song on the radio? Should it be playing ahead of them? Underneath the conversation, how much raised is it? And then, you know, has he got... You know, is it a mini disc player or is it an iPhone? So we had lots of sort of... conversations about kind of the questions of what will the audience, you know, how do we do this technically, and then how will it be that sort of seamlessness, and
yeah.
The fact that you're like, we pulled it off, I'm not quite sure how, but I think the kids that you see, they're from this estate and there is so much talent, and they were so brilliant, and they were all on for it, and we sort of rehearsed in our catering room. Actually, after breakfast, we sort of got them all in, and they all showed up, and they helped make that dance. So we sort of wanted to choreograph something that
Ex-ballet dancer, I just want to say. And choreographer.
So I've got, I'm a sort of want-to-be dancer. So anyway, I was talking to Claire about it, and it was how choreographed should it be, because it doesn't want to be too technically, it's got to look spontaneous. Sure. But I think the music, you should talk about MC Innes and the song, he's a local Homeward lad. They all know this song and Homeward. They all know the lyrics. Yeah. So there was a natural, they really loved this song, and I think it was, you found it. And so it's kind of, there was an organicness to it, but I think from the start it was very much scripted. And then it was about how do we make that seem organic.
But is that your musical taste? I mean, I had never heard the song before I saw your film.
No,
so.
I wouldn't say that was necessarily my musical taste, but he's... I really like the song, but he is a Homeward lad, and he did a special... he's MC Innes, and he did a special recording of it for us.
And also, you raised the spectre of country music, and then he said, and then folk music, I was getting fucking worse. So... where do you stand on folk and country, choir?
I like folk, Mark.
Yeah,
and
no.
I like Karen Dalton, was definitely my choice. And I found a banjo in the house that I'm staying in. I learned how to tune it. I haven't learned how to play it, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's fairly easy to play a banjo.
I did have a spare afternoon where I sort of learnt some very simple.
Did you go dang 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 dang?
I tried. You did. I tried, but yeah.
Do you know? So can I tell you my folk joke?
Yes, please.
Oh, sorry, it's just because it's a. So, how many folk singers does it take to change a light bulb? Change.
That's good.
Well, there's another version of that, which is how many folk singers it takes to change the light bulb. Five, one to change the light bulb, and four to sing a song about how great the old one was.
You don't like folk.
No, I love folk. I play in a band that plays, but it's, you know, it's the whole thing about, it's the, you know, country and western and folk are the two most maligned forms of music, and it's just they both feature in that scene. Did it feel to you like a different venture? I mean, I've been a huge fan of your features. I mean, I love the Arbor, and I was so fascinated by that thing about, you know, how do you refer to the dramatization of, what do you call that? The dramatization of audio recordings. What does one call it?
Oh, I don't know.
You literally call it the dramatization of audio recordings.
Yeah, maybe you do, yeah.
And then Selfish Giant, which was so powerful. Did this feel like a different kind of film to you?
Yes, and that was a lot to do with music, and I guess partly because it was a love story and because I wanted to make something that was very celebratory about Bradford and about people that Tracy and I really had got to know and love over a really long period of time. And, you know, The Selfish Giant and The Arbor, in a way, raise really important social issues about inequality and deprivation and marginalisation. And, you know, I think Ali and Ava does as well. But it's, I guess I thought it was really important to make something that showed how beautiful the city was and how kind people are to each other and joyful. So, yeah.
See, I think that really comes across, that sense of kindness, because it is, you know, it is an area which, when people talk about it, often think about it in sort of negative terms. And it seemed to me that this was... there's a real positive energy flowing through the film, which felt like a real rush of joy. And that's why I love the fact that it turned into a musical, because I think you are a musicals director, you see. It's like, you know, I think that's secretly what you've been wanting to do all this time.
All this time, yeah. There is some music in The Arbor, actually, with the au pairs in the... to kind of evoke that era. It was a lot of fun working with music, and it was a lot of fun kind of integrating it into it and kind of working with it right from the get-go, and yeah.
And how important, because you've got two BAFTA nominations?
Yes.
So it's for Adele?
Adele, yeah, yeah.
And
a British film, yeah.
And how important is that?
I think for a film like Ali and Ava, it's important because we don't, having said about budgets or whatever and time, we don't have a massive amount of budget to publicise the film or whatever. So yes, it's incredibly important.
From a producer's point of view, does it make a big difference?
I think. Well, you know, BAFTA, you're being voted on by members of, you know, the people you work with. So I think that that's, you know, I think that's really special. And I think that it's, you know, I think that Clio is, you know, a brilliantly talented British filmmaker, and so deservedly, you know, a female film director who, you know, in the minority. And I think we don't sometimes see, you know, this celebrates, it's an intimate story, and it's celebrating people, you know, putting a spotlight on people we might not always see on the big screen. So I think any chance that we can get to sort of spread the word, and you know, word of mouth, and awards help you do that, and for sure. And the chocolates are really great.
The chocolates are really great. Really fabulous. Really, yeah. Really fabulous. Do you think the world is changing? I mean, you said, you know, it should be celebrated because of a great female filmmaker. I mean, I think you're a great filmmaker as is, but is the world changing for women filmmakers?
Well, before I answer that question, I think one of the reasons I'm really pleased about the outstanding film nomination is because it's for everybody,
yeah,
and it's for everybody that was involved in the film, and it's such a collaborative process. So, you know, Tracy's in the canteen getting the kids to dance. You know, Kamal Khan is somebody who I've become very close to, very good friend, who's right this moment making his own short film, and was script consultant on Ali and Ava, and he was very, very, you know, it was very important to him how Bradford is represented on the screen. He's somebody who's from Bradford, and took me to very specific places in Bradford that he thought should be on the big screen. So, yeah. Moe was a collaborator, Rio was a collaborator, Adil and Claire, Amina, co-producer. You know, so it's a nomination for everybody.
Yeah. Now, I asked you to pick two films that were important to you, and you picked two which are really interesting choices. We're going to show clips from both. The first one that you chose was Rashomon, and I had done a BFI introduction for Rashomon recently. Can you remember when you first saw Rashomon?
Yes, I can. And
You say that in a worried way.
No, because because it involved talking about being a teenager. But, yeah, I was 18, and as you know, I'm sure there were only three channels on, and
yes,
you know, there was
in the same time that there was Walkmans, there was three channels, and the television went off at the end of the night
and made a beep sound.
Yeah, it went beep, and then and the best thing was the television finished, and then if you left it on, about 20 minutes later, it went, turn your television off, because they were worried about your house catching fire. This is true.
Yeah. Anyway, there also were really great films shown on TV,
yeah,
late at night. So, and Rashomon was one of them. And I guess now it's probably quite an accepted idea that there are that truth is subjective, and yeah, that different people have different truths. But certainly, when he made it, that in the 50s, that wasn't necessarily the case, certainly in cinema, and I hadn't seen anything like that before that raised those sort of questions and those kinds of ideas. And I think it really did have a profound influence on The Arbor, and particularly the opening of The Arbor, when you see the same story told by,
yeah,
two sisters about the same event who have a very different take on what happened.
We're going to show a clip which is notable for the fact that it's really, to get this ties very much into what we were talking about before about Chaplin and silent film acting. This is, I mean, there is dialogue, but this is very much, for me, silent film acting. Okay, here we go.
Oh,
I mean, it's, you know, it's Lillian Gish. I mean, it's just the extraordinary physicality of it. Okay, so I'm really glad you chose that, not least because it meant we got to show a clip from it on the big screen. Now, the second choice is a film that is very, very dear to my heart because I remember when I first saw it thinking, this film is far too rude for me to be able to see it. And I was really... So your second choice was...
Performance.
Which, when the BBFC first... Well, for ages, they wouldn't... The Warners didn't want to release it, and the BBFC thought it was disgusting, and the censors report said, even the bathwater is filthy. Which is just the greatest recommendation of all time. So tell me when you first saw Performance.
Oh, I was way too young. It was on television. Yeah, went on these three channels. I was 14, and my dad actually had an excellent record collection, and one of the records he had was the Rolling Stones, and it had this cover where all of them had their mouths squashed up against the glass. I don't know if you know that album. Anyway, I was slightly obsessed with this album cover in a probably quite unhealthy way. And I noticed in the TV listings, oh, he's in a film, this Mick Jagger. So I snuck the portable TV into my room, and because I wasn't meant to be watching it, I had the volume at one,
and
I had the TV like that.
Yeah.
And it was on at late. So that's how I watched it, and it really did blow my mind. And I think the bit where you go inside Mick Jagger's head is just... I think I understood from that film could be this very visceral, strange experience.
Yeah.
Like, wasn't just about telling a story. And also it did something really weird with what is real and what's fictional, because Mick Jagger is a rock star, and... oh my God, I'm blanking on her name. I'm saying Marion Faithful. No, Pallenberg. Thank you. Yeah, really, he really was in a relationship.
Yeah.
So so there was something there about the melding of fact and fiction that I found absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that had an impact on the kinds of films that I love, which are films that meld fact and fiction, and the films that I make, which kind of meld fact and fiction. And I guess my route into making films was through art school, and it's quite an experimental film, and so that was exciting to me and new to me. And I think the other thing that's significant about it is when at the age of 35 I went to the NFTS for a year. They ran this
that's the National
course.
Film and Television
no, sorry,
School
National Television School, yeah, and they asked me if I wanted a mentor. I said, yes, please. Who would you like? I'd like Nick Rogue, please. So I went and met him, and that was...
So did Nick Rogue mentor you?
Well, we had one meeting, Mark, but but yes, I'd like to... Yeah, so I went and met him in his house, in West London, which was sort of very different from the West London that is in the film, in Performance. It was brilliant in terms of him saying to me things that probably everybody knows, but I didn't know at the time, but that the love scene in Don't Look Now was not scripted, and they shot it because they felt that the relationship, the marriage, you needed to understand how intimate it was, and that was amazing to me, to understand that you might sit and watch dailies and go, oh, this isn't quite working, let's shoot this scene for this reason, particularly a sex scene that's as well known as that. He also told me that the script for Walkabout was 14 pages long, and that they expanded it in order to get the money, and then once they got the money, they went back to the 14-page version, which, so that was really fascinating to me in terms of script in relation to, what you do as a director. And the other connection for me, which I didn't know when I watched Performance, but was Sandy Lieberson, and who was the producer, which is why Tracy is so important, because I think producers often get... they should be in the limelight all the time.
Well, here we are correcting that.
Absolutely. So, he was the producer of Performance, and he was also the producer of Risu and Bob 2.
Right.
So when I made The Arbor, the very first person that I went and spoke to was Sandy.
Yeah.
who talked to me then about performance, and Reed Sill and Bob too, and Alan Clark, who, you know, I'm a massive fan of, and by that time sadly passed away, so I couldn't meet with him.
Okay. Tracy, you've seen performance, I presume?
Yes, but quite a long time ago.
Okay, well, we are about to relive the experience that you had of watching it literally up against your face, because you are sitting about as close. So I want to take you back to Clio's younger years, when she's in her bedroom with the sound turned down to one. This is re-experiencing, and this is a great. This is great. It includes male bottoms. They don't make films like that anymore. I mean, I have to say, the first time I saw it, my brain was completely fried. And partly that same thing is, I had no idea what was going on. Because it starts out, it's kind of a gangster thriller, and he takes it, and then it's just off in this. But I love the fact that you had that experience of it and being so close to it, and, you know, and it then. And I love the fact that you've just made a musical. So in a way, maybe this is your kind of your tribute to performance.
It was great watching it like that again.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. When does the film open?
4th of March.
4th of March. So do go and see it. It's terrific. And I wish you all the best at the BAFTAs. And thank you for coming. It's lovely to have you. So thank you very much. And thank you also, Tracy, for joining us. Thank you very much. There's been a lot of music in today's show. We're going to end up with another bit of music. We always end with sound and vision. When I was doing that thing for the Oscars about, you know, who I thought should be nominated and who might or who won't, I said I thought Jennifer Hudson's performance in Respect was fantastic. I don't think Respect is a great film, but I think her performance is brilliant. So we're going to close off today's show with this from Respect. It's just, it's a real musical wonderland. So enjoy. Isn't that fabulous? Okay, so look, we've overrun, but then I've never really kept things to time, and there've been so many people on the stage. So please join me in thanking, and we'll go backwards. So Tracy and Clio, James and Peter, Cherish. Jonas, did I miss anyone? Was that everyone? Nick, Heather and HLA for producing the show, the BFI. Thank you everybody for coming. Stay safe, see you next month.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that front row seat at MK3D. As I said, the shows happen at the BFI South Bank every month. If you like the sound of them and you'd like to come along in person, then go to the BFI website for details and tickets. But be warned, they do sell out pretty fast. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, subscribe and tell your friends. Until next time, stay safe and keep watching the skies.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.